Welcome, everybody, to the March 5th meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation.
How about the 9th?
It says the... Oh, excuse me, 9th. I'm looking in the wrong place. Oh, well.
We did that one already, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
All right, so we have a number of bills up today. We've got... I'm going to take up a couple that we've... and move them that we have... had some technical issues on before, and then I spend most of the time on Senate Bill 615, although I'm going to open just briefly on Senate Bill 581. We've got some accountants who are in the middle of tax season and drove down today, and rather than have them again, not yet, we'll let them testify. So let me start off with opening on Senate Bill 35, and actually opening a work session on Senate Bill 35. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 35 creates provisions for forms of notice, including electronic transmission, that telephone cooperative must provide to director, shareholder, and other persons. Details additional provisions for forms of notice that cooperatives must provide to director, shareholders, and other persons. Allows for a majority of votes of members or shareholders of telephone cooperative to approve the sale, lease, exchange, or other disposition of all or substantially all the cooperative assets, unless the cooperative's bylaws require a greater number. We do have a dash one amendment. It modifies notice of communication in newspaper to specify a newspaper of general circulation in the county that the cooperative's registered office is located. Adds members to cooperative's notice list, provides additional conforming modifications. There is no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
And we've got, so we need the dash one, right?
Correct.
We did hear this before, members. We've got the technical amendments we discussed last time. So the chair would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 35. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, the dash ones are adopted. So chair moves the Senate Bill 35 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition? There is none. So Senate Bill 35 as amended by the dash ones is moved to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Chair will carry. We'll close on 35. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 581. And
now's the time.
Now's the time. We'll let you get back to tax season.
I really appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 581 changes fee for application for a renewal or permit to practice public accountancy, changes fee for application for a renewal of registration of business organization of certified public accountants or public accountants, declares emergency effective on passage. We do have a dash two amendment, increases fee for application for or renewal of permit to practice public accountancy from $160 to $255, increases fee for application for or renewal of registration of business organization of certified public accountants or public accountants from $175 to $265. There's no revenue impact, and it has a fiscal light statement. It also has, it will need a subsequent referral.
Okay.
I have a question for staff.
Go ahead.
Is that biennium or is that yearly, the increase?
That's a good question. Let me look it up.
Okay.
It is not the intent to move this today.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Senator Beyer, Vice Chair Senator Gerard. Oh, and just for, it is biennium, just so you know. Members of the committee, and for the record, my name is Keith Myers. And on behalf of approximately 4,700 members of the Oregon Society of CPAs, we respectively submit Senate Bill 581. I'm a past chair of the OSCPA Board of Directors, and chaired the legislative committee for many years. And in these roles, I've gained a good understanding of the board's budgetary process and funding sources. And additionally, I've been a CPA since the early 80s. The board has a responsibility for licensing about 6,600 licensees, either CPAs or PAs here in Oregon, and about 1,000 accounting firms. The individual licensees renew their license on a two-year period, and so that the fees we're talking about here is a biennium fee increase. Senate Bill 581 contains an increase in fees for individuals and the firms, and the board is primarily funded by these license fees and firm registration fees. It does not obtain any funds from the general fund. The changes as contained in this bill are the result of a detailed analysis of the board's budget and the forecast of the remaining of this biennium and the next two bienniums. And through this process, the board anticipates a budget shortfall, resulting in a significant drop in the board's ending balance, and without a proactive increase, it will not be sustainable. So the shortfall is a result of many factors. Number one, the fees haven't been increased since 2006, and the board is currently running a deficit. The board has also been advised of some increases and changes from state governmental services like the Department of Administrative Services. The OICPA understands the importance that the board does by being properly funded, and we are accountants, so we understand the budgetary process. Therefore, the OICPA is in favor of making the following changes. Number one, currently the individual license fee is set at $160. We propose a fee increase to $255. For accounting firms, it's currently at $175. We propose an increase up to $265. As part of the previous mentioned analysis process, the OSCPA invited representative input from the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants, OAIA. As we reviewed data and determined the needs in the course of action, we've kept them apprised of this. We're not speaking on behalf of OAIA, but we have included them in our analysis process. Having adequate resources to support public protection is an important concern, mutually beneficial to the profession. CPAs and PAs perform a broad range of technical services for the public, and the public relies upon the regulatory protection of a financially viable board. So the board must have adequate funds from biennium to biennium to support the activities connected with this oversight. And on a case-by-case basis, the board does have to have investigations into certain situations. CPAs and PAs are required to abide by detailed and highly technical professional standards, including a code of professional conduct. And we are also subject to multiple levels of regulation. So the Oregon Board of Accountancy is empowered to take disciplinary action, suspend and revoke licenses of CPAs and PAs who violate either laws, regulations, or our code of professional conduct. Additionally, the board protects the public in holding out situations or situations where individuals who are not licensees hold themselves out to be CPAs or PAs, but are in fact not licensed. So we urge you to pass Senate Bill 581. The bill will protect necessary funding of the board to continue its important work. We believe a financially stable board is required to effectively and efficiently regulate the CPA profession in Oregon and to protect the public. Thank you for taking me out of order. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
I got one small one.
Sure.
Could you get to me how much your legal budget has been for the last couple biennium?
I cannot.
Oh,
but there's, we have people from the board here.
Okay.
Yeah. There can.
They can.
Oh, my God. That looks familiar. Okay.
Well, come on up. We're not going to take action on this today, so if you'd rather do testimony at a later date, that'd be great, or if you want to make it quick today.
No,
we'll make it very quick.
I don't know why.
I'm trying to do it as a courtesy. Mr. Myers, go ahead.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, I believe your question was around roughly the size of our legal budget.
Right.
I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but just to give you a little bit of a rough idea, in the overall, this biennium, we had about roughly a $2.2 million biennial budget. And within that, I believe we had about an initial authority of about right around 160. For DOJ. Okay. However, we are significantly above that, in part with the help from you and others, because we had to do an e-board deal because of our caseload. So it's actually going to be our actual expenditure level is significantly higher this biennium than that number.
And Martin, could you identify yourself for the audio record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Martin Pitioni, Executive Director, Board of Accountancy. Thanks.
And you're from out of town, too. You're a member of the board, so go ahead.
Okay. Excuse me, Chair Senator Beyer, Vice Chair Gerard. Excuse me, Senator Gerard and the rest of the committee. My name is Larry Brown. I am the current chair of the Board of Accountancy. I've been in the accounting profession for almost 40 years. Prior to being on the board, I spent 6 years on the Complaints Committee. I think that this bill, Senate Bill 581, is vital for continued enforcement. I have other comments that are posted, and so in the interest of your time, I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? I guess none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did you have those, your comments introduced into the record?
Yes.
Okay. We got them then. Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I appreciate
Thank
it.
You. Thank
Let's
you.
Let's get back to tax season. Okay, we will close public hearing on Senate Bill 581, and let's see if we can do just very, I'm very cognizant of this. Fred, can you do this, like, really quick?
If Senator Amy, joins me.
We'll open very quickly a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 472. James.
Senate Bill 472 increases maximum number of Pacific Wonderland registration plates from 40,000 to 80,000. We do have a dash one amendment. Permits monies to go to the general purposes of the Oregon State Capitol Foundation as opposed to just to establishing and maintaining an Oregon History Center at the State Capitol or on the grounds of the State Capitol Park. We have a revenue impact that's light and a fiscal minimal impact, and it also has a subsequent referral to finance and revenue.
Okay. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Betsy Johnson, Senate District 16. Good bill should pass.
Great.
Senator Beyer, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Fred Neal, Chair of the Capital Foundation, thank you for your ongoing support for the Capital Foundation and its continuing efforts to improve upon and embellish the People's Building.
Great. Amy, do we have a problem with this?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Amy Joyce, Department of Transportation. I don't have a problem with it, and I can answer any questions. I submitted a little bit of written testimony.
This is probably one of our more successful plates.
Indeed it is.
Okay. Any questions, members?
Good bill should pass.
Good bill should pass. Seeing none, thank you very much. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 472? Seeing none, and we have a dash. What is it?
Dash one.
So we will close public hearing, open work session. Chair moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 472. Discussion on that motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition? Seeing none, the dash ones are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 472 as amended by the dash ones to Senate Revenue, right? Mm-hmm. Senate Finance and Revenue. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 472, as amended by the dash ones, is moved to Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. And we'll close the work session on that. And I'm going to turn this over to you and open on 6:15.
You want to open here or you want to do that one?
No, I don't want to. We're going there next.
Okay.
Right.
We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 615. What is that? You want to give us a staff summary, and what do we got here?
I'll go over this with this sheet right here first. Senate Bill 615 creates seven-member Oregon Retirement Savings Board chaired by treasurer or treasurer's designee, directs board to develop defined contribution retirement plan for people employed in Oregon, sets requirements and limitations of the retirement plan, establishes confidentiality of information regarding individual accounts, establishes retirement saving plan administrative fund to pay costs and expenses of administering plan, directs board to report to appropriate committee of legislative assembly by December 31st, 2016, directs board to establish retirement plan unless the plan would not qualify under the Employment Retirement and Income Security Act of 1974, so individuals can make contributions by June 16, 2017. Declares emergency effective upon passage.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6, Central Lane and Linn Counties. Mr. Chair, you will recall that in the last session we passed a bill that established a task force to explore the problems with lack of savings in the state for retirement and the growing problem with that. the state treasurer, who you'll hear from later this morning, headed up that task force and made a report, which we've all gotten a copy of. Things haven't changed much since then. The fact of the matter is that young people particularly, but people in general, are not saving adequately for their retirement. I think the problem that this will create as we move forward into the future is if you kind of move it forward another 30 years, my big fear is that young people will be an incredible burden on those who are still left working because they will not have adequately saved for retirement. Part of the reason for that is the culture around that has changed. When I entered the workforce, almost every employer had a pension plan of one type or another. Most of those were defined benefit plans. Those are almost non-existent anymore. In fact, I've been involved in a couple of organizations where we did away with it and moved to defined benefit plans, 401ks or SEPs. Unfortunately, not many people have those available, and they're just not retiring. Although I suspect you'll hear a lot today from people who would suggest that there are lots of different vehicles out there for people to avail themselves with. The reality is they're not. And so I think if we're trying doing our service as a public policy body, looking ahead, we have some opportunities. The opportunity that you're presented with in this bill is to establish a retirement security board. I forget what we call the technical name, but it's a state board that would establish a state plan that all employers who don't have existing plans would be able to make available to their employees. Their employees have the option of opting out, but if they don't, it's there. It's for ease of operation, I think. And the research has shown that when you have these kinds of plans, I guess it's human nature. I call it sort of the strongest force in the universe is inertia. And if they don't have to do anything, it'll happen. They will start savings. And perhaps down the line, they will even do better. But this is a good program. It's modeled after, if you will, the college savings program that we enacted in the 90s. It's been very successful. It will not be a publicly managed plan. It will be a private plan that some company will receive the award for. It's my assumption. We will try to stay away from ERISA. The bill specifically says stay away from, and that's the federal retirement plan. So I think we'll solve a lot of the problems there, but it's a great idea. I think it's an investment in the future. Just looking across the dais, it doesn't affect any of us. but it might affect my colleague to the left here.
Perhaps your committee administrator.
Perhaps my committee administrator. That's true. So with that, Senator?
Sure. Thank you, and Mr. Vice Chair and Vice Chair Gerard and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Diane Rosenbaum, State Senator for Senate District 21. I'm very pleased to join my colleagues today in support of Senate Bill 615. This bill would help prevent the potential of a retirement savings crisis in Oregon by creating a user-friendly and portable way for Oregonians who aren't saving for retirement to save through their paychecks. Senate Bill 615 will help avert a retirement savings crisis in the future by making it simple for Oregonians to save through a payroll deduction. As of 2012, only 55% of employed private sector workers aged 24 to 64 in Oregon had a job that offered retirement benefits, whether it be a traditional pension or a 401k-type retirement account. That means that nearly half of all those private sector workers had no ability to save through their job whatsoever. So saving through an employer is not the only way to prepare for retirement, but it plays a critical role because it prompts people to save and offers a simple way to save through payroll deductions. And we know that fewer employers are offering retirement savings plans than in the past. The reality is that without access to a user-friendly way to save for retirement, nearly half of Oregonians will find themselves far below a secure and sustainable level of retirement savings. Now, I'd like to talk about one aspect of this problem that is particularly significant to me. This harsh reality I've described is especially true for women, low-wage workers, and people of color, many of whom face the inability to save money while working full-time. Women are far more likely to be among the poorest retirees in our state by a very wide margin. Our low-income seniors are also much more likely to be women. Women make up about two-thirds of minimum wage workers and average less than 70% of the average savings of men. Further, according to the National Institute on Retirement Security, only 54% of African American and Asian employees work for an employer offering a retirement plan in 2013, and only 38% of Latino employees worked for such an employer. To help these Oregonians start saving, Senate Bill 615 creates a voluntary retirement savings option for workers who do not have a pension or other employer-sponsored retirement account. This option is designed to be simple for both workers and employers. The workers will choose the amount to be automatically deducted from their paycheck and professionally invested, and employers provide a packet of information and facilitate the payroll deduction. The retirement account would be portable, so workers can keep it if they change jobs, and workers could opt out of the system if they didn't want to participate. This program is specifically designed with market research and legal advice from the Federal Department of Labor to avoid conflicts with federal law and liability for the state or for private employers. The objective of this effort is to get more Oregonians saving, so Senate Bill 615 provides a baseline option for the hundreds of thousands of Oregonians who, as I've described, face alarmingly low retirement savings. Our bill, Senate Bill 615, will help working Oregonians who don't earn enough money to put aside much money each month. As mentioned previously, a high percentage of our low-wage workers lack even the access to a retirement savings vehicle. With this legislation, even a low-income worker saving responsibly over the course of a career can put together a nest egg that will make a difference in old age. Senate Bill 615 will eliminate barriers to saving and make a bright retirement future accessible to Oregonians across the state. Thank you again for hearing the bill today. I strongly encourage your support for this important policy.
Okay, let's hear from Representative Reed, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. You've heard some good testimony, I think, about the importance and the urgency of this this problem. I simply want to underscore that with a couple of points, and then with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd love to walk through the bill briefly so you can understand how it works. My colleagues have already underscored the urgency, and I just want to reinforce how relatively simple this approach is, even amidst what sounds like a very complicated and overwhelming problem. What we want to do, of course, is make a plan that's easy for employees and have minimal responsibilities for small businesses. Control is retained by the individual, and as you've heard, it follows people from job to job, giving them the chance to get an early start with professional management and low fees. I was really struck by a statistic that came from David John, who now works with AARP, who was previously with Brookings and the Heritage Foundation. He noted that when an Oregonian, or presumably anyone else in the country, has access to a retirement plan that's offered by their employer, 71.5% of people take advantage of that in some form or another. But if they have to go out and find their own plan, the number of people who take advantage of that is 4.6%. We should be concerned about that, I think, not only for that person's welfare and their own future, but for us as a state, because obviously when someone does not have resources to use in retirement, they become more of a demand on services that are funded by the legislature. I think this has a tremendous potential for us to give people a chance to take control of their own retirement and the chance to retire comfortably and with dignity. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd love to just walk you through the bill. It is also worth noting that we, in our continuing efforts to refine and improve the bill, we have -3 amendments that I think clarify and simplify things even further from the bill. But the bill is written. Section 1 establishes the Oregon Retirement Savings Board, which is housed in the Treasury, has 7 members, including a representative of employers, employees, and a person with experience in investments. Section 2 addresses the duties of the board, which include establishing and implementing a retirement savings plan, adopting rules for the general administration of the plan, conducting a thorough market and legal analysis to identify the most attractive plan and most effective plan for Oregonians. Section 3 outlines the requirements for that plan, which include, among others, automatic enrollment of employees with the option of opting out, using existing employer and public infrastructure to facilitate contributions, and requiring no employer contributions to those employee accounts. Those terms are in the bill in order to establish plans easy for employers, professionally managed, and to allow Oregonians to begin saving for retirement through a voluntary plan. Section 4 deals with the rules that the board must adopt for the plan related to the process for voluntary enrollment in the plan, allowing employees to opt out of the enrollment, for allowing an employer to gain an exemption from offering the plan if they offer an alternative plan, and for adopting rules that ensure the plan is not an employer-sponsored retirement plan. Section 5 ensures that the individual account information is confidential. Section 6 sets up the administrative fund. It's in Treasury and is used to pay the administrative costs and expenses of the board. Section 7 outlines the prerequisites to establishment of the plan, including market analysis to determine the feasibility of the plan, legal advice regarding ERISA, and coordination with other states who are undertaking similar efforts. Section 8 requires the board to report to the governor and to the legislature annually. Section 9 states the Department of Revenue will be responsible for withholdings and the subsequent deposits in plan accounts. Section 10 requires the board to report to a legislative committee on the findings of the market analysis and legal work, timeline for implementation, an overview of contracts and recommendations on how to increase financial literacy. Section 11 requires the board to establish itself in 2017. And Section 12 states that the appointments to the board must be made with terms starting by September 1st of this year. So a very quick overview. I'm proud to be with my colleagues here and look forward to your questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and colleagues, one other thing that I would point out is this really is a nonpartisan issue. There are a little over a third of the states that, as we speak, either have established or are in the process of establishing similar programs, and those include both red states and blue states.
Okay. Any questions? Is that right?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. just a couple of comments. I really appreciate you bringing this bill. I think it's a very good bill, and especially the transportability. I think that's extremely important for young people working today, that the job movement is more than it used to be, and transportability is very important. So thank you for bringing this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley is a veteran of the revenue. Senator Riley, excuse me, I used to say Representative Riley.
Yes.
You, as a veteran of the Revenue Committee, you are no doubt familiar with the impressive charts about the impact of compounding interest when started at an early age, and that's one of the really important aspects of this bill, I think, to help people get started and get into the habit of saving at an early age. So thank you for highlighting it.
Senator Thompson?
Thank you, Co-Chair. Thank you very
Vice
much.
Vice Chair, that'll work.
Vice Chair? Okay. Vice Chair Drawn. How about the ag industry? Because I see it being kind of cumbersome with seasonal workers. If you make it mandatory, because a lot of times somebody might come to during harvest and work for me one day, and then I don't see them again until they pick up their paycheck, because they it's just the way that industry works. And sometimes it'll be they'll work like the folks that live at our place will work 20 days to prune. They'll go prune for somebody else for 20 days. They'll go to the Dalles. They'll go to California. It's a very moving population. And then they'll come back and work for a couple of weeks and go somewhere else. It's just the nature of seasonal work. How, and if somebody comes to me and I'm required to, or the only way they can get out is to opt out, but if they don't make that connection in that day when we have 60 other people walking around, it's one more thing for somebody to do that they're probably not thinking about. Well, what's the liability of the employer on that? And how do you keep track of all that stuff?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, the intent is to make it as easy as possible on employers, and we don't think that it will be a significant burden along the lines of the same kinds of withholdings that you're already doing. You also are correct to recognize that an employee could opt out at any point. So we imagine that the specific processes will be worked out by the board, but the intent is to make it easy for people to connect their earnings with a retirement option.
Anybody else? I actually have a couple questions. First, I'd like to make a statement. I applaud the effort. I think it's really good. I wish that we start looking at student debt, because I think that's contributing to the fact that people aren't retiring.
Indeed.
And I think that's a major problem as well.
Indeed.
I got a couple kind of major questions. If you have a big company like Intel or Nike that have they have self-funded retirement plans, does this still require that the state have their plan, or is there an opt-out? In
Mr. Chair, it does not. The employers who are offering retirement plans that are defined in other parts of the Internal Revenue Code would allow them to not be affected by this legislation. This is specifically aimed at folks who don't have access to a retirement plan, to make it easier for them to put their own money into a retirement savings vehicle.
Okay, if somebody moves out of state, are they still going to be able to invest, or how does that go, since we have a lot of people that go across the border?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think, and I'm happy to be corrected or have Senator Beyer or Senator Rosenbaum make an addition, I think clearly the money that they had contributed is theirs. It is theirs. No one else owns it. They maintain control of that. I think it may be harder, depending on what other states have similar programs in place, to continue the payroll deductions. That would depend on what that other state has in place. But clearly, the money that they've contributed is theirs.
Well, I understand it's theirs, but can they still participate if they live in Idaho in the plan?
Mr. Chair, I'm a little reluctant to give a definitive answer to that, because I haven't spent time thinking about that. I think I think we would want to make it easy for people to make contributions, but I think it would be hard for us to impose that requirement on employers in another state. Does that make sense?
No, say that they're established here. Say they work for a company, and they get transferred to Idaho, but he didn't offer a plan. The question is, if they're in Idaho, can they still contribute and to the Oregon plan? And I would think the answer would be
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I think the intention is yes, although obviously it would be a lot harder to do it through payroll deductions.
Ask the state treasurer when he comes up.
Mm-hmm. I've been told to ask the state treasurer, if you haven't heard that. I'm good. Anybody else,
Senator,
have any questions?
That would be desirable to do that. I think that will really, when you get down into the details of that, sort of like what we went through the college saving program, it probably depends somewhat on who gets the contract and how that's set up.
Yeah.
But my guess would be that they probably would be able to.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead, Senator.
I guess
Thompson.
If an employee that's in the plan gets to a point and they want to opt out and take their money with them, will they have to sue to do that, or is there a way to get out of it like 3 years in?
Sure, Senator Thompson, at any point they can say, I'm not going to contribute anymore, I'm done participating. And again, I think it would be possible to roll those over into other retirement options. Just like the other retirement plans that now exist, there are penalties if the person wanted to cash out, as you said. But I think the option to roll it into other retirement vehicles would exist.
Oh, I'm good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's a list there.
I was really worried about having to use the gavel here. Treasurer Wheeler.
Thanks, man. Yeah. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Gerard, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the state treasurer.
I'm speaking to you in that capacity as well as the former chair of the Legislative Task Force on Retirement Savings. And it's also, I think, noteworthy that I've served prior to elective office about 20 years in various capacities in the financial services industry, including in the retirement planning sector.
Kristen Johnson, Senior Policy Advisor in the Oregon State Treasury.
So I'm obviously here to express my strong support for Senate Bill 615. I want to thank you, Chair Beyer, and Senator Rosenbaum, and Representative Reed, and many other people who've worked very hard to help lead this issue. I want to start my presentation, if I could, with the results of two recent polls. I know we're all elected officials and we're always intrigued by polling information, and there's two polls that I found particularly telling. The first showed that of all of the financial issues confronting American households, retirement savings is by far the issue that Americans worry the most about. A second poll showed recently that by a factor of 4-1, Americans fear running out of retirement savings more than they fear their own deaths. I think that's a telling statistic when it comes to how important is this to the average American and the average household. There is, as you've heard from the previous panel, broad bipartisan acknowledgement that the nation is facing a retirement security crisis. The National Institute for Retirement Security has estimated that the current retirement savings deficit in the United States ranges between $6.8 and $14 trillion. Their bottom line conclusion was that retirement savings are, quote, dangerously low across the board. This issue is obviously urgently being discussed all around the nation on a bipartisan basis. There are no fewer than 20 states currently taking up the issue of retirement savings. Amongst those of us who serve in the capacity as state treasurers, this is an issue that's been discussed at great length in recent years. 2 years ago, our National Association invited Larry Fink to come and speak to our group. Larry Fink is the founder and CEO of the world's largest money management firm called BlackRock. He made the case that the number one threat to the U.S. economy is the longevity of Americans combined with our lack of retirement savings. I've also been part of a national discussion that includes Democrats, Republicans, and others who are concerned about this issue, and we've created a bipartisan coalition to support states in helping to navigate some of the questions that you've been raising and other questions that have been asked about the appropriate role of state governments in helping to address this issue. We worked together to co-found a national research institute to help inform these discussions, and I was pleased recently to have the opportunity to have two of my colleagues come from that panel and participate in a City Club of Portland discussion on retirement savings. Just to underscore the bipartisan nature of this issue, to the left of me I had Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, who is the late Robert F. Kennedy's eldest daughter, and to the right of me, probably in every way, shape, and form, was my friend Ken Melman, who served as the former chair of the Republican National Committee, and he was George Bush's former campaign manager. All three of us made the case that states should provide the leadership around this issue of retirement security. You'll have a letter available to you from Mr. Melman encouraging your bipartisan support of Senate Bill 615. So this is an issue that is national, it is bipartisan, and I have to say it's also not a new issue. Nearly 20 years ago, the Oregon legislature created another task force to look at this issue of retirement savings. Back then, the issue was, of course, concern about inadequate retirement savings, but there was also a lot of discussion about the baby boom demographic and what that meant for retirement security. And there were also legitimate questions being raised about the solvency of the Social Security system. It could be said then, as now, that Social Security was never designed or intended to be a sole source of retirement savings. You should know that the average Social Security benefit here in the state of Oregon is about $1,300
per month, the average. And that puts you somewhere in close proximity to the federal poverty level. Again, that's just the average. You created a task force, again, in 2013, and I had the honor of being asked to serve as the chair of that task force. You asked us to do a couple of things. You asked us to take professional testimony. You asked us to take a look at the current state of retirement savings in our state. And you asked us to come back to you with recommendations on what, if anything, the state should be doing in terms of an approach to help improve retirement savings for Oregonians. The first thing we did was we looked at the work of the task force 20 years ago. And I'm sorry to say that most of that work was simply put on a shelf and ignored. The second thing that we learned is the situation for Oregonians has only grown much worse during the most recent 20-year period. Part of the issue is demographic. We know that over the next 20 years, the number of older adults in this state, people over the age of 65, is going to double. And the facts show very clearly that far too many of those folks are going to retire with less than adequate retirement savings. Now, I get asked all the time, what's adequate? What is the right amount of retirement savings? There's various rules that experts rely on, but if you combine them all and take a look at where the center, the fulcrum is of that, those recommendations, people typically recommend that you have 8 times your income saved for your retirement nest egg. So if you make $50,000 a year, that means you should have something in the neighborhood of $400,000 saved for your retirement. Unfortunately, in Oregon, we're way off of that. Recent AARP statistics show that something in the neighborhood of half of Oregonians have saved less than $25,000 for their retirement. Another statistic shows that working Oregonians between the age of 45 and 64 have saved less than $5,000 for their retirement. And as Senator Rosenbaum's testimony illustrated, women, people of color, young people, people who work for small businesses are far less likely to have adequate retirement savings because they tend to be clustered in jobs that are either lower income or they're part-time or they're more episodic. And that is a very unfortunate double whammy, particularly for women, because the reality is women live longer than men, and therefore, by extension, they should have more retirement savings than men, not less, which is unfortunately the case. So our task force heard from a variety of experts. I'm not going to go into all of it. I'll just say we heard from nonprofit leaders who talked about the rapidly increasing cost of caring for older adults who have not saved adequately for their retirement. This is a trend that's well underway in Oregon, as it is nationally. We heard from behavioral economists who talked about some of the structural and behavioral barriers to saving. That starts to get to the answer to the big question, which is why, with all of these private sector retirement saving tools and vehicles that are available to people, why do we still have such anemic savings rate? Behavioral economics talks all about that. We heard from small business owners and operators, some who are very excited about the prospect of having access to a simple and low-cost retirement planning product for their employees, but we heard from others who expressed equal concern that the state's involvement in this sector could lead to additional costs or burdens for small businesses that are already struggling in the state of Oregon. And of course, we heard from the financial services industry. Again, it was divergent testimony. We heard from some people who were excited about it because it obviously represents a market expansion opportunity. If we can reach people who aren't saving and connect them with private sector products, that's good. Yet we also heard from other experts from that industry who saw this as government intrusion in what's historically been a private sector market. And last but not least, every one of our meetings had an underlying current, a theme, a debate, if you will, about the appropriate role of government. At the end of the day, when all the discussions were over, we recommended that the state of Oregon develop and offer a voluntary retirement savings plan to all Oregonians who do not have access to a retirement plan through their place of employment. We further recommended that the plan have certain attributes, all of which are encompassed in Senate Bill 615, amongst others, but attributes that help overcome some of the structural and behavioral barriers that we heard expert testimony on. So in addition to being voluntary, we heard that the plan should be easily accessible. Whether it's right or whether it's wrong, that means through the place of employment. Oregonians, Americans generally, expect to get their benefits through their place of employment, whether it's health care benefits, whether it's health insurance, certainly whether it's a retirement planning product. Americans expect to get their benefits through their place of employment. This is a very important structural point because, as Representative Reed said, data shows very clearly that people are 15 times more likely to save for retirement if they have access to a retirement savings plan through their place of employment. 15 times more likely. And yet, half of Oregonians do not have access to a retirement plan through their place of employment. And we also heard testimony that simply putting the products out there in a storefront is not sufficient. You have to connect Oregon employees with those private sector products, and the platform that works by far the best is the place of employment. Whether it's right or whether it's wrong, them's the facts. Then there was this question of automatic enrollment. We heard very compelling testimony that if people are automatically enrolled in a plan at the time they're employed with the right to opt out, they're far more likely both to participate and to contribute more. And follow-up surveys conducted, having as a subject people who've participated in auto-enroll programs, show that they're very popular for people who are engaged in those automatic enrollment programs. The program should be a payroll deduction. You heard how that works, and I'm prepared to answer further questions on that. It should be simple. We heard that an easy plan is a better plan, meaning fewer, easy to understand investment options is desirable. In my mind, that means something along the line of index funds. And the structure of the plan itself should be simple. For me, I would advocate for an IRA like product for a number of reasons, but not the least of which is that it's easy to understand. The program should be low cost. For our task force, what that meant is pooled and professionally managed financial resources. Pooled to keep the costs down and be able to compete on economies of scale. Pooled to keep the returns as high as possible because it's being professionally managed by a private sector firm that understands how to manage those assets. You heard about portability. You were very clear with us that you wanted any plan sponsored by the state of Oregon to not incur any fiduciary liability on private sector employers under the federal ERISA statutes. You were very clear that you didn't want any ongoing cost to taxpayers. In other words, the plan would be self-supporting, paid for out of investment fees charged to individual accounts for those employees who choose to voluntarily participate in the plan. This is a very familiar strategy for us because it's exactly how we pay for the 529 college savings plan. And last but not least, you said that you wanted no financial obligation, ongoing financial obligation or liability to the state of Oregon or to its taxpayers. Senate Bill 615 accomplishes all of those goals. It is simple, it is voluntary, it is easy to understand. With an IRA-like product, it subjects employers to no fiduciary liability under ERISA. It would be self-supporting out of fees paid through the program like the 529 College Savings Plan. There is no guaranteed coverage of returns or losses. There is no ongoing fiduciary or financial liability to the state of Oregon or its taxpayers. There is nothing new or particularly radical about this plan. What it does is it leverages the private sector and existing private sector products. What's new is through the place of employment and through auto enroll and through some of these other structural features, we're able to connect those products in the private sector with Oregonians who today are not participating in private sector retirement plans. That's the long and the short of it. It leverages the strengths and advantages of both the public and the private sector. If you vote for Senate Bill 615, you're creating a board. That board, which by the way includes two legislators, is there for transparency and accountability to the public. That board would then develop the product using the attributes that I've outlined that are specific to the bill, to Senate Bill 615, and then it would put it out to the private sector, where the private sector would compete for the right to run the program on behalf of the state of Oregon, which sponsors that program. We know this model works because it's exactly the same model we use today for the 529 college savings program, and that is proven to be a very effective model. In conclusion, I would say this. If we cannot find ways to encourage people who can save for retirement to voluntarily do so, the cost to taxpayers will be staggering, as more and more people rely instead on costly government safety net services instead. So it's with that that I encourage your strong and bipartisan support for Senate Bill 615. Senator Beyer, if you would like, I could answer the questions that were deferred to me, if that is helpful, or I could just wait for people to
have at it.
Senator Thompson had asked the question about agriculture. What happens if somebody comes in and works a day? They're automatically enrolled, if we interpret the bill as currently written literally. What happens and what is the employer's obligation? The plan is directed towards people employed for compensation in the state of Oregon. So if you have one person come in and they work one day and you report that one day of payroll, you would have the deduct in for their participation in the plan if they have not opted out. That is the end of your commitment, because the relationship isn't between you and the employee. The relationship is between the employee and the private sector firm that's hired to run the program. That one of two things will happen is either that employee will take the plan with them and continue to contribute, or they will forget about it. And I don't mean to be flip, that happens in this industry. Those are called orphan accounts. That liability isn't the state's, and it's not the employer's. That liability becomes a liability of the private sector firm that's competitively bid for the right to the program. They know all about orphan accounts and how to calculate how many they're likely to get, and that is part of their consideration when they're trying to estimate how much they want to bid for the right to this contract. But it's not the employer's liability.
So I'm assuming there's going to be a form to opt out.
Yes, sir.
So how long will I have to keep that form? Because I can see legal services coming to our place and asking people if they opted in or opted out. And it's just one more thing that all the employers are going to have to keep track of. What if they lose the form? Is it going to be electronic? Is it going to be paper? You see some things. It's a new thing. It's going to be something, a lot of issues to be worked out. So what are those kind of issues?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, an entirely fair question, and all of that needs to be defined through the rulemaking of the committee you impanel. If you were asking me one logical scenario, that form would be paper. It would be handed out in the packet to employees, and it would have a time limit on it if it were up to me. But it's not up to me. That's really up to the legislative body and the rulemaking of the committee that you would impanel. But I want to acknowledge that what you're raising is a legitimate issue. Chair Beyer, there was also a question of what happens if somebody moves out of state, potentially to Idaho. I think it was Senator Girard that asked that question, if I remember correctly. The answer is They would still be able to participate in the plan just the same way they can still participate in the Oregon 529 College Savings Plan, but it would no longer be a burden of the employer because they are no longer in the payroll system of that employer. So, again, it's up to the rulemaking of the committee, but the assumption is, in my mind, that it would work like the 529 College Savings Plan, that you would send a check off to the company that's managing the program on your behalf. And then the final question was asked, I think, again, Chair Beyer, by Senator Thompson. I could be wrong. The question was, can you get out if you're 3 years into this and you change your mind? The answer is yes, and there's two ways you can get out. Number one, you could roll it over into another qualified plan, a 401k program or whatever your new employment situation is. You could continue to support it if you wanted, but if you wanted to get rid of it entirely, you could withdraw it. But under my scenario, where you're using an IRA-like product, which is already recognized by the federal government, there are rules pertaining to penalties for early withdrawal, meaning prior to your federally recognized age of retirement. But there's nothing that prevents you from doing that.
Other questions? Senator Girard?
Yeah, I actually have a few. You mentioned that there's no guarantees lots of times. I hate to remind you, but PERS started out the same way. And a future legislature could very well put a guarantee in there. It's a slippery slope. And that's, I think, probably one of the major fears that I have, is all of a sudden we're going to have an 8% guarantee like PERS, and we can't meet, you were having trouble meeting that obligation. So can you tell me how we can make sure that we don't have a guarantee? Because I like the concept. I honestly do.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, and thank you for the question. There's an old truism that holds true in politics as well as in the private sector, which is you can never guarantee that people won't do something stupid.
No, that's the legislature.
The whole purpose of this program, as you charged me as chair of the task force, was very clear. Perhaps more than any of the states that are looking at this, and perhaps it was because of the hard work we've done around the pension system in recent years, the charge was very clear to not bring you a proposal that subjects Oregon or taxpayers to any ongoing liability. And that's what we've provided you. I can't speak to what future legislatures will do, but it strikes me as a long shot possibility. That's my personal opinion.
Mr. Treasurer,
yes, sir.
I think the other side to that one is because it won't be a publicly managed plan. It'll be a private sector management that's I can't conceive how a future legislature could ever kind of do that trick.
It seems like a long shot, Mr. Chair.
Oh, yeah.
I got a couple more questions.
Sure, yes, sir.
How much is this going to cost to implement?
Senator Beyer, Senator Girard, we have estimated approximately $750,000 in startup costs. And that is commensurate with what we have seen other states do. Most of those startup costs would be used for what is described as a market study to further refine which product would be best suited, what people would be most interested in. You've heard my specific testimony with regard to IRA-like products. There's a question about whether you should get the tax advantage up front or on withdrawals. That's an open discussion. There is also the matter of drafting a good RFP. And as we rolled out the 529 College Savings Program, my understanding is we spent several hundred thousand dollars drafting and issuing an RFP for that program. And I'd like us to use the same level of diligence with this program. I will also tell you that when we launched the 529 College Savings Program, there was no cost to taxpayers. The College Savings Plan actually took a loan from the legislature for the startup costs, and we promised to pay that loan back in 5 years. It was paid back in 3 years out of funds charged to the 529 College Savings Program. Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, that is at your discretion.
The other question I would have is, you talked about a storefront approach and that you didn't like that, but I was trying to visualize that in my head. Buying a mutual plan, a mutual savings account, wouldn't be beneficial to investing in a state IRA or whatever you want to call it. So I'm just trying to figure out why the state needs to be involved, and this couldn't be done through the private sector.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girod, the main thing that the state can do that the private sector is not able to do on its own is reach hard-to-reach populations. The private sector has tried very hard to, and I used to be part of this, so I'm not casting aspersion, has tried very hard to reach Oregonians with retirement savings product, but has failed for nearly half of Oregonians. In part, it's because they're not particularly good prospects. When you look at the way that the private sector makes money on private sector retirement savings products, it's through one of two means. It's either through assets under management, which is the primary means, or it's on fees charged to individual accounts. The accounts we're talking about that don't currently exist tend to largely be lower income, part-time, or more episodic employees. We heard the testimony from Senator Rosenbaum. What the public sector is doing here that's advantageous is through this program offered at the place of employment with auto enroll and some of the other features that we've created, we're essentially gathering up a lot of these smaller accounts and making them an economically viable single pool of resources to be managed by a private sector company. So what may not be economically viable to manage today as a product would be under this product.
Treasurer Wheeler, I would assume part of that, too, is that you're reducing the marketing costs.
Substantially, yes, Mr. Chair, through
marketing,
economies of scale.
I would say marketing and sales costs. So
yes, sir.
Reducing the upfront, which makes it easier to provide the service and cheaper.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
The last question I have is the return on investment. You mentioned IRAs, and you want to model that after an IRA. I don't have the data, but I don't think on an IRA investment, if you're getting 2 to 4%, you're probably doing pretty darn good.
It depends on what you invested in.
Well, but I mean, in all honesty, it depends on, I mean, if you're in a highly risky pool, you can make more money during good times. But I know if you're just in, what kind of return on investment are you anticipating? What kind of range?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girod. It entirely depends on the investment options that are available, that are made available by the private sector provider of the plan. And I'm assuming, and this is a big assumption, that there would be a wide variety of potential options from the board to choose from very conservative to very aggressive options. So I couldn't sit here and say the rate of return that is assumed is X. But the most important thing here is that the state and taxpayers aren't guaranteeing that rate of return. The relationship is between the employee and the private sector provider.
I understand the no guarantees. It's just I'm trying to figure out a way how you're going to market this to employees to sign up when you don't have a track record or anything like that.
Senator Beyer, Chair Beyer, Senator Girod, maybe the most helpful thing for me to do is I've got a convenient cheat sheet that I use when I'm speaking in public that I unfortunately do not have with me at the moment that gives the average returns in our various diversified portfolios. You would see that they range from about 6% up to about 14 to 15% in a given year based on different allocations of assets. And I could provide that information. But really, it's going to be the individual's choice as to what level of risk tolerance and what sort of allocation they want in the portfolio. Again, if it were up to me, there would be more limited options, conservative, moderate, not conservative. or however you want to couch it, and those would be the options. But I don't think we want to make any representations whatsoever about rates of return. That's not going to be a role of state government under this program.
And Chair Beyer and Senator Gerard, if I might add, the MyRA that
and
President...
Identify yourself, please,
Kristen. Oh, sorry, Kristen Johnson, Senior Policy Advisor, Oregon State Treasury. The MyRA that President Obama has suggested that we use, and we've already started, and the federal government has started opening that up, the only investment option is Treasury bonds, and that has a much lower return of investment than something that we would be able to offer. So, you know, I think certainly we'd be able to offer something more, much more competitive than simply Treasury bonds, and it would certainly allow participants to access high-quality services that they would not be able to otherwise access.
Chair Beyer and Senator Gerard, if I may just provide a little color commentary. I'm not dodging your question. The answer is I just don't know. It depends on what the investment options are and what the allocation is and what people choose, what they choose to do in terms of their allocation. Representative Reed had mentioned compound earnings. The key that we're missing by not having people participating in a private sector savings vehicle is they're missing out on the value of compound earnings. When I go out and I talk to school kids about it, I call it the magic, because it really is one of the most powerful economic forces on the planet. The ability to invest and reinvest over a period of many years gives you what industry people call the hockey stick, and you need to start saving early and often in order to gain access to that hockey stick. The fact is that a 22-year-old who puts in a little bit consistently over a career is going to have far more saved for retirement than somebody who starts at age 45 and puts in a lot. And so one goal here is to get people to begin the habit of saving early in their career so that the burden isn't borne by taxpayers down the road when people have not done so. And right now the path we're on is half of Oregonians are not saving through a private sector plan at all.
I think the example you're throwing out, Senator Rod's comments, Ms. Treasurer's, if you looked at just what options state employees have through their deferred compensation program on top of their PERS retirement, there's a whole raft of options out there, much as it's in. You could use an index fund, or you could use a money market fund. You probably wouldn't want to use a money market fund today, but there's safety versus higher risk and more rewards. But those are really questions, if this passes, for the savings board to deal with in their RFP and discussion with whomever was the company chose to manage it and what products they would offer, which I would assume would be probably one of the criteria that they would use in the RFP, is to say what options can you provide to people. Senator Thompson.
Yeah, I've heard you're going to withhold 90% of their paycheck goes into this fund. Is that correct?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, no, there would be a default rate that would be set by the board. That might be 3%. That might be 6%. It would be set by the board. That would be the default. No, it absolutely would not be 90. Then.
Okay, I just pushed because nobody really ever tells the truth up here. Yeah. So, you know what that number? Do you?
No, that would be.
It's gonna be preset, but is there parameters if we pass this bill? Could they start at 5 or 7? How do we know what that could be? Do you have any idea?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson.
That's a lot of money.
You're correct. That would be a default rate would be set by rule by the board. However, that would be set, you know, probably 6% or 3%. Participants would be able to opt out of that default rate and set their own rate. So if they wanted to contribute less, if they wanted something like 2% of their paycheck, because that's all that they could afford, they'd be able to do that. If they wanted to contribute more, say 10%, they would be able to do that.
Well, then if they can default, how often could they go to the employer? Once a week, once a month, once a year, and change that rate? Will there be something in the rules that says they can only do it once a year?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson.
Unless you mess with that.
I agree. That would be left to the board. It's not addressed in the bill, but that would be left to the board to create rules around how often that could be changed, perhaps annually. But that would be, again, left to the board.
So, follow up. California is in the process of doing this. They're not doing it yet. What have they come up with in those parameters? Can you find out? If you don't know, and let me know.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, I can find out for you. I believe it's 3%, but again, they're still working on the details of their bill. But I can respond to you directly with that information.
There are a couple other states that actually have a separate. Connecticut?
That's correct. I don't think Connecticut has a rate set up or a default, an automatic IRA. The state of Illinois has one. I think their contribution level is set at 3%, but I can get that information for you. I don't have it in front of me.
I suspect we're going to have somebody who can address that in a minute.
Okay, and then one more. Could you find out if they've done anything different with the ag industry than they do the rest?
There's never one to ask a question.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, yes, I can do that for you. Several states are looking at this. I think each state will have something somewhat different. I know Kentucky is in the process of doing something similar right now. They're in the middle of their legislative session. Their bill is, I believe, pretty similar to what we're looking at doing. So I will get that information to you.
Great. Thanks.
Senator Jura?
One last question. I've been kind of thinking up here, and there's only one time I think that this wouldn't be a good deal, and that would be if somebody had a tremendous amount of credit card debt. I mean, can we put maybe a clause in there that you might want to pay off your credit card debt before you invested in this? It's the return on it's not comparable, because you talk about compounding your interest, well, you're compounding your debt. So I think that they need to be have their credit cards under control.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, one aspect of the task force I've not had a chance to mention was the robust discussions we had about financial literacy programming and the lack thereof. Mm-hmm. So this bill also calls for the board to do a more in-depth presentation back to the legislature on strategies around financial literacy. While this particular Senate Bill 615 is creating a retirement vehicle that requires, in my opinion, a minimal amount of financial understanding, you are correctly pointing out that there is a universe of financial issues that households have to manage. You mentioned college debt earlier, which is a huge deal for younger Oregonians in particular. And we should be doing more to help people understand how all of these different household financial tools fit together. And so I'm committed to working with you, Senator, and others to help strengthen the programs we have here in the state of Oregon, because we need to do much more in that department. But we also heard that financial literacy programming, while important, was not sufficient in and of itself to overcome the structural and behavioral issues that are called out in Senate Bill 615.
As I recall, that's one of the things that we used to require in high school as part of the curriculum that we've eliminated. Yes, Senator.
Just another little thing. I mean, you're going to get a million of these things are going to come up. I have an employee and I have to garnish their wages. Can I skip the automatic, if it's in the middle of the year, can you skip the automatic deduction to, because they're not going to hardly have any money to live on, because they're garnishing wages to pay spousal support or kid support. That's important too.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, you're right.
But how does that get in there?
They could opt out.
Any time of the year they can opt out? I thought it was once a year.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, there's no rule yet. Once a year would be my suggestion to the board for setting up that by rule. The employee would be able to opt out, I believe, any time. But again, that's all, that's all speculative.
Since it is set up, it's proposed as voluntary, I believe you couldn't have a rule that did not allow them to opt out at any time.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, that would be my understanding as well.
So you can opt out any time. So I could have an employee opt in 1 week, just opt out the next week. Opt in 2 weeks later. I mean, so where do you draw the line?
Chair, Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, I believe that you could always opt out. I don't know how often you'd be able to opt in. My suggestion to the board would probably be to limit the amount of times that you can opt in so that there aren't as many bouncing back and forth.
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, if I could chime in on the board has an incentive to limit that kind of what I'll describe as churning, because that's going to be one of the variables that the financial services institution are going to be very interested in. If they're the ones that have to administer this program and their ability to do so successfully depends on it, they're going to want to know what rules we're establishing prior to their bidding on this program. So the fewer changes, the fewer options is going to keep the cost lower. I'd like to add one bit of thought to the wage garnishment, starting with the understanding that I don't know the answer and we need to look into it and we'll get back to you. There is probably a legal order to things when it comes to things like child support and alimony. I am not an attorney, so I cannot speak to that, but there is probably a prescribed way of doing this that's already done in the private sector that I need to look into and get back to you on.
Go ahead. One last one. Yeah, you said that before.
That was me.
I don't disagree with doing this because we all grew up, at least my generation, told by our parents that we should save money for college, save money for retirement, all that stuff. And we don't seem to do that. Maybe part of it's because it's pretty tough to tell your kid to go put some money in a CD and get 0.02% interest.
That's right.
It's hard to do that incentive. But it's like when you're doing, you know, a person that we're going to be withholding this money from is saving clear out to retirement, which is a long ways away. When I first came back, I thought, oh, I'm going to budget. My dad's never budgeted any farm stuff. And by golly, I'm going to set a bar. And we're going to spend $500 a year on new tractor tires. The first month, I had four tractor tires blow up. And I told my foreman, nope, we can't replace those tires because I only had $500 in the budget. Well, that didn't work very well. So I just see what the opting in and opting out, somebody's going to go in there, they're going to have unexpected expense, a medical expense, four blown tires in their car, and they aren't going to have enough money to be able to opt in and opt out. I just see that happening a lot because it's tough to... tough to deal with those everyday issues.
Senator Thompson,
what you're doing, though.
Point well taken. And the advantage of the structure that's proposed in Senate Bill 615 is that's a cost that would be borne by the private sector provider who has voluntarily chosen to bid on this program. So when they submit their bid, the burden is on them to understand the dynamics of what might happen in those plans. And that's why, personally, I think it's a good idea to leverage the private sector and private sector products, because this is what they do. These are issues that they're far more familiar with in terms of how it impacts the economics of the plan.
Oh, and I like you because you're not an attorney.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Treasurer, for spending so much time with us.
Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I just one comment.
Go ahead.
I would like to see you up in my office, you know, when you got a chance.
Isn't this where everybody goes, ooh?
That's right. The principal beckoned.
All righty. Let's hear from some small business folks. Penny Wicklander, Bobby Sultan, and Carmen Matthews. I've got three chairs there. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Whoever wants to go first.
Go ahead. Oh, okay. Good afternoon, Chairman Beyer and committee. My name's Penny Wicklander, and I'm a home care worker. And since I felt this was so important to come and talk to you about it, I got up at 5 o'clock this morning and drove over from Pendleton.
Oh, wow.
So, anyway, I'm a little tired because, of course, that was the, you know, the day I lost sleep. So, I've been a home care worker for 6 years, and before that I was an apartment manager for low-income HUD housing. And so I'm going to talk about the retirement savings plan for all, but what I saw when I worked there was very, very sad. I mean, when he talked about the average Social Security being $1,300, a fair amount, especially the women, had worked in restaurants or stayed home with kids, and they were lucky if they were getting the minimum amount. And so to me, that just seems really unfair that there's people that work construction and make lots of retirement, and then there's those that don't have the same ability to do for it. My own situation is that my husband worked construction. We traveled around. Although I worked, never was there long enough to, you know, get a retirement program going. So at my age now of past retirement, I wouldn't be able to retire if it hadn't been, you know, for the program of my husband. And so I find that, you know, really sad for women who, you know, I was home with kids, but I was also working, but not able to make enough money for it. While I was working as an apartment manager, the elderly that were there had no savings retirement. I mean, they probably couldn't afford to, or would not be allowed to live there with that. So I saw a lot of people living on bare minimum amounts of money. And at that time, there wasn't the Medicare D, and it really came down to whether they were able to buy food or prescription or medical things that they needed to do. The people that lived there, most of them had HUD assistance. They were on food stamps and they were on Medicaid. So that puts a burden on society. So if we could figure out how to make a program, which it sounds like we're going to do, it's something to me that's going to be really important. I have an employer right now. She's 86, lives in some HUD housing, and I'm seeing firsthand what is looking forward to a lot of people that are out there that aren't as fortunate as those that have a retirement. And I know that for myself, I did put some money away, but you have to have large amounts for you to get into a good program like what we're talking about putting together to get any money out of it. If not, you're just barely working for nothing. So I just hope that you all will consider what will happen. Social Security, we don't know, is going to be here in the next 20 years or thereabouts, and so that's going to leave a lot of people without any retirement, and we will have to pay for it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Byer.
Pull the mic over, please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just a little bit. Don't have to get real close.
Chair Byer and members of the committee, my name is Bobby Soten, and I'm a home care provider. I've been a home care provider for 14 years, and I'm a member of SEIU 503. I'm here today in support of the Senate Bill 615. As a home care worker, I care for seniors and adults with physical disabilities, and with the services I provide, it allows seniors to stay independent and in their homes. I love the work I do, and I do believe that our community values my work as well. However, in this job career, I don't receive much benefits through my employer. One of the key things I'm missing is a simple and secure way to save for my own retirement. I'm a lucky one. My husband had a previous employer that started retirement for him, and like a lot of people, he lost a lot of money in the systems that are currently available for people. It's taken 10 years to recover what we lost. And It's, I don't have any way of saving for retirement for myself. I'm not able to save a lot of money. So my children are not saving for their retirement. My parents were home care workers in, late in their career. And they didn't save either. My father was self-employed for many years. And so when they reached retirement age, they had no retirement. And so they had to make a decision to live in poverty or keep working. Sadly, both of them have become disabled and cannot continue to work. A lot of home care workers see their own future as they care for the people they care for that did not have a retirement of their own. So this is why I am in support. I think it's very important, even $50 to $100 a month to the people I care for, even just $50 to $100 a month would make a difference in their life. So this bill is necessary for me, for my coworkers, for my family, and our community. The simplicity of the system being proposed is key to getting more of us saving for our future and setting up to be more independent in our golden years. Please vote yes for Senate Bill 15, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, sir.
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, I'd just like to thank you for taking the time to hear my support for Senate Bill 615. My name is Carmen Matthews. I am a small business owner. I own a Seven Devils Brewing Company in Coos Bay, Oregon. Drove here today to voice my support for this Senate bill. I am currently employing 15 people, and during the summer it swells to about 20. And as a new business owner, which we've only been in business for about a year and a half, my wife and I are the we wear many hats, you know, CEO, CIO, COO, you know, whatever you want us to do, that's what we do. And we are still trying to expand at the time. There's a lot of steps to get a small business started, and as you can imagine, I'm quite busy. I haven't had enough time to set up a retirement program for my employees currently. That is something that I would really like to do, but I would really like to announce my support for the ability to do this in a simple way across the board through small businesses, because of the fact that when given the chance, employees will more often say yes to something that is readily available to them. I've heard the argument that it would be difficult to implement on a small business level. Currently, I do lots of deductions for my employees, whether it's child welfare or garnishments. It's really not that difficult, even for a small business owner that's only been in business for a year. I think adding one more is not going to be that much of a burden. In addition, I really see the value of it. A lot of concern was brought up about the availability to people who are seasonal workers, and as a business that does have seasonal workers in a restaurant situation, I still see the merits of being able to deduct automatically just with the packet that the employee gets with initial in hiring. I love what I do, and I don't really want to get out of that current role that I'm in, but I also want to be able to take a break when I'm older, and I would like to see my my generation be able to do that as well. A lot of my employees are like family to me, and so taking care of them is really a high priority, but for me right now, the time has been difficult to set aside to build that program. And additionally, to manage it, I really think that something like this is if it's readily available, more people will take advantage of it. And I know that personally, when I had the opportunity to take that advantage at the age of 22 through a coffee company, I took it. Since leaving that coffee company, I have not continued my investment in that particular program. However, if it was readily available and followed me from job to job, I guarantee you I would have. So I really think that this bill is something that would benefit all of the citizens of Oregon. Either way, even if they didn't invest in their retirement, I think that it would help us in the long run in terms of the taxpayer dollars that has support for the elderly care. So I just want to say thank you for taking the time to hear our testimonies, and please vote yes.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. I'm trying to, I've got a long list of people here, and so what I'm going to try to do is first go to those that have indicated they're more than 100 miles away. That's our policy as a legislature. Then I'm going to try and get others who aren't here every day up first. So let me call up Sarah Gill. And let's see here, John Mangan. Welcome.
Thank you.
Take it away.
You can go first.
Hi, my name is Sarah Mishevich Gill. I work with AARP's national office in Washington, D.C., and I really appreciate you all taking the time to hear our testimony today. Thank you, Senator Beyer, Chair Beyer, and committee. As you've heard earlier, people are 15 times more likely to save if they can do so from their employer. We have continued to talk about financial education for years, and yet access to retirement plans has declined. 401k balances in Oregon have stagnated, and healthcare costs have risen over the last 10 years. Although education is necessary, it's certainly not a sufficient solution to solve this problem. We're excited about the flexibility and choice that this plan offers at AARP. Employers always retain the right to use the retirement product of their choosing, and it's always voluntary for employees. We're creating a plug-and-play option for small businesses that reduce their administrative and legal burdens. You already heard from many folks before me about the bipartisan nature of this issue. If you have specific questions about what other states are doing, I'd be more than happy to answer them. As I mentioned, I'm in Washington, and my job for AARP is to work with all of the states that are working on this private sector retirement security solution. So you already heard that it's a Heritage Foundation concept originally, that it's been passed. Studies of this issue have been passed unanimously in states like Utah and Virginia, but I would like to specifically mention one recent study that was done by Brigham Young University in Utah. They found that taxpayers would save $200 million over the next 15 years if the lowest income cohort would save a modest amount, 10%. 10% is not too much, 10% more than they're saving right now. Taxpayers would be the beneficiaries of that. They'd save $200 million. It's not a long time horizon. It also found that, to your earlier question, one out of five people are currently retiring into debt with negative liquid assets. So education alone really isn't enough to solve this. I'd like to speak really quickly to some of the issues that I know have been brought up in other states and will likely be brought up here as well. In particular, you are likely to hear or have already heard that MyRA is an option, a federal solution, if it were, to this problem. Well, MyRA is an additional tool in the retirement security toolbox. It is not a panacea. There are several reasons for this. Number one, first and foremost, is it's not ubiquitously available. Currently, only 40 companies offer MyRA nationwide, 40 companies. It's not available via employers in very many places, and according to the Treasury Department, they don't expect it to be available from every employer anytime soon. It's completely voluntary. Furthermore, it has serious limitations. You heard the Treasurer's Office earlier refer to the bond funds being the only type of investment, so individuals are not able to take full advantage of the market. And furthermore, there's a huge cap that prevents them from saving enough money for it to be sufficient. You can only save $15,000 in a MyRA account before you're required to roll that money over into another account. So essentially what they're doing is creating a way for individuals, once they've amassed a significant amount amount of money to roll over into another account, which, as you know, many of the folks on the federal side right now are considering the fiduciary rule, or also known as the conflict of interest rule, that when you roll those monies over, the person who you're using to help roll those monies over does not have to be a fiduciary currently. That may change in the future, but right now that's a big issue. You'll also hear about ERISA. We always hear about ERISA when we talk about this issue, and you've heard a little bit about it today. First and foremost, let me say that this is carefully crafted. The provision before you is carefully crafted to be within DOL's ERISA safe harbor guidance. Employers are only responsible for payroll deduction. This is intentional. They are not supposed to give advice, advocate for a plan, or at least in this case, be required to contribute to the to this model. The bill explicitly states that they can't be responsible for market gains and losses, and that's really important. But I think it's even more important to take a look at what DOL has said about similar issues recently. DOL has shifted their opinion over the last 6 months, so I would say that anything you've heard from them prior to that may not be as instructional as what they have recently said about MyRA. And because it's so important, I'd like to, if you could indulge me, read a little bit from the MyRA letter that they just actually released. It says, this is from DOL. Under the MyRA program, employers would provide employees with information and enrollment and election forms made available by the Treasury Department, very similar to what you have before you. In order for employees to make contributions to a MyRA account, the employer must agree to forward the employee's payroll deduction contributions. Employers would be expected to cooperate in process or procedure that Treasury or its financial agents establishes to ensure that the employee withholdings are being promptly and correctly remitted. Again, very similar. Employers would not make employer contributions to MyRAs. They would have no investment or other funding obligations or have any custody or control over account assets. Although MyRA program is designed to provide retirement income to individuals, including employees, we do not believe that Congress intended in enacting ERISA that a federal government retirement savings program created and operated by the U.S. Department of Treasury would be subject to the extensive reporting, disclosure, fiduciary duty, or other requirements of ERISA, which were established against the possibility that employers' expectation of a promised benefit would be defeated through poor management of a plan sponsor and other plan fiduciaries. Here's the important part. Thus, given the character of the program, including its voluntary nature, its establishment, sponsorship, and administration by the federal government, and the absence of employer funding or role in the administration or design, the department is of the view that an employer would not be establishing or maintaining an employee pension benefit plan within the meaning of ERISA. That's very important because the plan before you has a lot of the same qualities. It is voluntary. Employees can opt out. Employers are not contributing in this case. They are not running the plans. That's done through a private sector entity that you would contract with. This is very similar to the MyRA issue. So as I mentioned, DOL, while they haven't been explicit verbally, they have been on other plans. Furthermore, please note that the President's FY 2016 budget language included language supporting a state-centric approach to retirement security. And in fact, they included funding for a pilot program for DOL to work with states on issues just like this. So the administration is looking to the states. And as we mentioned earlier, 20-plus states are looking at this. And a lot of that is because of what you guys have done. They're taking their cue from the good work of Oregon. Now, you'll still hear that DOL hasn't ruled on this plan maybe yet, and that's an issue. But what I want you to know is that ERISA is the current order of the day for businesses as it is. It is not some big, scary thing that we should all be afraid of. ERISA is employee protections, consumer protections. Currently, if a plan sponsor, if an employer wants to go out and create their own 401k now, they would still have to be under ERISA. There's not some new amazing regulatory burden that's being put on them by this plan. In fact, it's quite the opposite. We're exempting them from that ERISA issue. So, as I mentioned, this is a federal law that's aimed at protecting consumers, and it's really a red herring in this case. Finally, I just want to mention again that well over a dozen states have looked at this, including Illinois, which is currently in the process of implementing. Massachusetts just got their letter of recognition from the Treasury Department about pre-tax deferrals. Connecticut's board is creating a plan. States red and blue, North Dakota, North Carolina, Indiana, Kentucky, Utah are all considering this, and a lot of it is in part due to your hard work here. Some of the industry support we've seen in other states include TIA CREF, Cabrera Capital, Ariel Investments, ASPA, the National Association of Women Business Owners. The list goes on and on. The business community really just does not speak with one voice on this issue. Kentucky, New Jersey, Maryland are all considering legislation similar to what you have before you today. As I mentioned, Virginia and Utah unanimously passed studies. And I ask you today to reaffirm your commitment to financial security by passing Senate Bill 615. And I'll take any questions you may have.
Thank you, sir. Did you have a question?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Chair Byer. I guess one of the things, I didn't throw this in last time, so...
Just one last question.
Well, just one last point. this isn't something like on the campaign trail or wherever I go, nobody ever talks to me about it. The only time I've ever heard about this is when I come to this building. And I guess if you know, something like if you're telling your kids they need to save, they need a savings account, and they save, and they never do a savings account. And now, you know, we've made a lot of young people in our state and all over the country sign up for health insurance beyond. It wasn't something they were in an invulnerable age or whatever, but we forced them to do that. I just never have a lot of people come up to me and say, please force us to do a savings account. So that was just one more thing I want to throw out. But in these other states that you're looking at, they're just in the planning stage. Nobody has done this yet, so there's a lot of task force reform because they really don't want to do it, but they just say we're going to do a task force. So are those legitimate task force set up in those states, or are they just like some task force I've seen here that you just say you're going to do it so you don't have to decide and you put it off another year?
So let me first speak to the first comment about whether or not folks really are interested in this. I love that question. I get it all the time.
Okay.
Well, I guess it wasn't a question, but I'm going to take it as such.
All right.
Recent polling has shown that millennials are more concerned about their retirement than Gen Xers. That blew my mind. I'm a millennial, just barely. But I have friends all the time who are saying, how do I plan when pensions are no longer reliable? When if I'm working for a private sector employer or a public sector employer, pensions, it's a scary thing for a millennial. But they are doing better at saving than their cohorts were Gen Xers or baby boomers. They're saving more money now than those age groups were. And they're so interested in it. In fact, you heard earlier from, I think it was Treasurer Wheeler, who mentioned this is the number one issue. During the election last year, they polled, I think it was an SEIU poll, they polled swing voters. And swing voters said that more than health care, more than any other issue, retirement security resonated with them personally. So I think the issue really is access. I think when you look at one out of two folks not being able to save for retirement at work, they feel like they're drowning, and they really need help, and they don't know where to start. So oftentimes talking about something where it's all over your head is a little bit disconcerting. So I think that might be part of the issue. And to speak to the second point about where states are in the process, as I mentioned, Massachusetts has already created a plan and, in fact, has applied to IRS to get their treasury, to get their letter of support for pre-tax withdrawals. So I think that's already well in the works. Connecticut's board is not just a regular board. In fact, they have the authority to create a plan and are in the process of doing that. But they're kind of taking their time and going slowly. California also has a board. They're trying to do a feasibility study. They've saved over $1 million to be able to run their feasibility study. And I think one of the really great things about talking to the treasurers across the states is that the treasurers do intend to use each other's work to save their taxpayer dollars. So we are learning things from California, from Minnesota's study, from Connecticut's study, that can be applied in Oregon in order to save money down the line. And you heard that with the feasibility study earlier. And then Illinois is in the implementation phase as well. So they are actually putting together a plan that's supposed to be up and running within the next year or two.
Has there been, and maybe I missed it,
any consideration on making this tax-free? Or is it tax-free?
Tax-free, as in post-tax or pre-tax?
Yeah, you don't tax this.
Sure. A lot of states have considered both post-tax and pre-tax, and for different reasons. I think there's a general proclivity towards making things pre-tax because it comes off the top of your payroll. You don't notice it, which I think is the intention here per the language. But some states like Illinois have chosen to do Roth, and that's because of the state tax deferral consequences. So it's really up to you guys about what you'd like to do.
Is there an amendment to that? Maybe I would do to make it tax-free.
You'd have to speak with the sponsor about that. I'm not entirely sure about what the intention is here in Oregon in particular, but I could speak towards other states.
I don't believe it specifies. It would be probably, am I correct? It doesn't specify whether it's tax-free or post. That's really a question that would come up in the design of the program.
Right. And
my assumption, Senator, when we've been talking about it, would be pre-tax.
Pre-tax.
And either way, it's not tax-free necessarily as it is tax-deferred versus taxed up front.
Yeah.
And if you use
is that the way they're setting it up, tax-deferred?
It
comes off.
That's the way the Oregon bill is. I think the intention is there, tax-deferred.
It'd be great to make it tax-free, but I don't think the feds would agree
with it. That's what I was going to say. You could try.
Sign me up. Any other questions?
Others?
Thank you, Sarah.
Of course.
Sir? Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mangan. I'm a regional vice president with the American Council of Life Insurers. We actually hold about $4.7 trillion of retirement plan assets that are voluntarily placed with us, so we have some experience in this field. But today I'm actually speaking on behalf of a much larger group of employers from around the state, and also financial services providers and professionals from around the state. And they're all listed on our letter of, unfortunately, opposition to this measure, which I believe is in your file. And before I begin, Mr. Chair, because we do have a number of things to talk about and things we disagree with, unfortunately, but I wanted to ask you about your time frame because I know you're running up against
some. I lose this room in about 12 minutes.
Right. Let me see if I can hit some high points for you.
You've got a letter in?
Yes, we do.
So if we could just do that, then I'll see if I can catch some others who aren't here for that.
Great.
In town.
First of all, as I said, all the plans we offer are voluntary, including plans that are offered to employers who can voluntarily choose to do auto enrollment. But we always give the employer the choice of doing that because it's clear when the employer does an auto enrollment plan, it's going to be subject to ERISA. And we want to make sure they make that choice to take on that liability and that it's not forced on them. And unfortunately, we just disagree entirely with the fact and this stated by the witness here and also by others, that this is a voluntary plan. We believe it's a sweeping mandate, in fact, for employers, and we don't believe it's completely voluntary for employees. The safe harbor of ERISA requires that the plan be completely voluntary for employees, not that it be auto-enrolled. So we have a significant question about that, which I'll get to in a second. But I also want to just point you to the bill and say that this board, once you create it, has the power to, as stated in Section 2, develop the plan, whatever that may be, because we don't know the details of it yet, and then it can establish, implement, and maintain the plan in Section 3, and it can do all that, we believe, without any further guidance or approval by this legislature, and without knowing whether the plan will be tax-preferred or whether it will be a post-tax product. That makes a difference, because the fiscal note in Connecticut on the pre-tax plan was $140 million of lost tax revenue in the first 2 years, obviously, because people are putting a lot of money in through auto enrollment that's no longer taxable. Or if it's post-tax, then, of course, it's being deducted from employees' checks after tax. And we're talking about middle and lower income people who, I believe the witnesses have already stated, are barely making ends meet now and would have an auto deduction of 3 to 4, 5, or 6% off their after-tax income. So the impact of this bill is important, and how that plan is created is important, and how you judge the cost going forward. But as far as we can tell, the board can actually implement this plan without any further action by the legislature. Now, if you look at Section 3, we believe this bill imposes a mandate on employers, because what it says, and it's not particularly transparent or clear, but this is the exact same plan, I agree with the other witness here, that has been proposed in California and Connecticut and Illinois, and also at the federal level in Congress. It's an auto enrollment IRA provided through employers, whereby they are required to auto-enroll their employees.
They're required to give them the option.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to clarify that because I know that's an important piece of Section 3 here. What Section 3 says is that, yes, you want to allow eligible individuals employed for compensation, that would be any employee, part-time, temporary, seasonal, or full-time, to have access to this payroll deduction. Item B says require an employer to offer its employees the opportunity to contribute to that plan through payroll deduction. And the third item says provide for automatic enrollment of those employees. The next item says have a default contribution rate set by the board. Only the board can determine the rate. Offer default escalation, that's from year to year, at a rate, again, set by the board. Now, in order to accomplish the providing for automatic enrollment, the employer has to auto-enroll their employees. That's what it is. So as soon as they have to make this available, that means that they have to go in and say, I have 100 employees, and I need to enroll them right now in this plan. Now, they can opt out, that's true, but the first action that the employer has to take is that they have to auto-enroll them. That's what Section 3 says. That's how we're reading it. We think it's unclear at best, but we believe this is clearly a mandate. It's not voluntary. And because it's not voluntary, we get to the ERISA issue, which I'm sorry to bring it up again, because it is the most critical issue. And we've heard all the previous witnesses say that this plan, as proposed, would not be subject to ERISA. And it would fall within the safe harbor. And the safe harbor, in addition to requiring that the plan be completely voluntary for employees, which has never been shown, an auto-enrollment plan has never been shown to be completely voluntary. That's an open question. But the second thing that has to happen is that there can be no endorsement by the employer of any plan or product. The employer can have no other role except to collect a contribution and pass it on to this vendor, whoever it may be. But in the case of this auto-enrollment, this Section 3 of the bill clearly says that the employer must use a default account set up by the state, maybe contracted out with some private vendor, but the state has created an account and set a default rate by the board, and the employer has to follow that set rate and put the money in a default account, which means the employer has made a choice on behalf of the employee. And all we're saying, Mr. Chair.
Sir, I get your point. Do you have other points that you
sure,
want to make?
Sure, I'll close. It's okay, I'll just close then. If it's true that this doesn't fall within the safe harbor, then the state and each and every participating employer we're talking about that's required to participate will be subject to ERISA and will be subject to all the costs, risks, and liabilities of ERISA, regardless of what you've heard today. That's my final statement, Mr. Chair, but I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Questions?
I got one quick question. Yeah. The quick one, do you see any way that the state could be liable for losses? I mean, there's no guarantee of earnings. Say that we had a major downturn like we had where we lost 40%. Do you see the fact that the state could be sued or not on a class action suit?
Mr. Chair and Senator Girod, that's exactly the liability we're talking about. As soon as you set up an ERISA plan and involve employers, the employer is accountable to the employee. In every other plan, private workers have rights. They're protected by federal law. You can't legislate away that protection by just doing it at the state level. Only Congress can do that. If the employee sues the employer, we believe they have a right of action against the employer under ERISA, and we believe the state would also be liable because the state, frankly, is the sponsor of this plan. The state is creating it, defining it, telling you what it is, telling you what you have to do, telling you what the rates are. We have a legal opinion that we've submitted to the committee, which also supports both of those points, and we would encourage you to read it.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Both of you. I've just got a couple minutes left. Barbara Perrin, you came from out of town. Is there anybody else who came from out of town that would like to make a brief comment? You can give it a shot. Come on. A couple of you at a time. But I've got 8 minutes, so. Go ahead, Barb.
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak. I would like to let you know that as a member of the baby boom generation on the leading edge of that, one of half a million AARP members in the state of Oregon,
And most importantly, I was a single mother. I forgot to say my name, Barbara Perrin. I'm from Eugene, Oregon. I would have loved to have been able to have the opportunity to participate in a program like this when I was younger and a single mom. I am speaking specifically for women and women whose lives are taken up with raising families, whether they're single or in a partnership or marriage. We have a lot on our plate. We always have had a lot on our plate. And if I had had the opportunity to participate in something that was portable, as this one is, accessible, right there where I worked, and I didn't have to go out and do a bunch of research to find out, you know, what was going to work for me and what I could afford, I most certainly would have participated. I'm positive. On this end of my life, I'm looking back on what I did do, which was to invest in real estate, which is what, you know, I was pretty certain was going to be okay based on the history of investment of, you know, people like me, not big-time investors. And it turned out to be not the best thing that could have happened for two reasons: the recession and the collapse of the housing market. I did lose most of the equity in the home that I invested in, and my equity, and that was something that was going to tide me through, along with my Social Security. So to make things brief so everybody else can speak, I would just like to say this is very, very important. It should be passed, and I would encourage you to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. And I would note that if you have written testimony, we will get to that. And also, this is not the last day we're going to hear this bill. So people will have another chance. Those of you who sort of play around here every day will have another day on this. So please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is John Burnside. I'm an independent registered investment advisor in Portland, Oregon. I live in Happy Valley, Oregon. rather than dish out statistics on how Oregonians aren't saving enough, I just want to share my frontline experiences in working with individual investors. I have a pretty unique experience where I started out at a Wall Street investment firm and then worked at a prominent discount broker, and now I own my own registered investment advisory firm. And my main point is I wanted to just state that I've witnessed firsthand how investors with low balances, they really do have a deficiency in the availability to education and products and service. I think they truly are treated as second-class citizens in the financial world. And why is that? The more sophisticated advisors have high minimums. You know, it's harder to, or it's easier to manage 100 clients than it is 1,000 to 2,000 clients. The prominent discount brokers, you think they would like to help, but they're all publicly traded companies, and they encourage their investors to day trade, and which, in my opinion, is more gambling than it is investing. There's a lot of online options available, but they're definitely more for the tech savvy. And if anything, there's too much information out there. There's thousands of websites pushing investment strategies and products, and it's confusing for the experienced and knowledgeable investors. So I think there's truly a need for a trusted source, which I think this bill can develop. And then once the smaller investors, once they build up a relatively respectable amount of assets, they can use that as leverage to go out to the financial services companies and get better products and services and education.
Thank you, John.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer. My name is Scott Roots. I've been a financial advisor here in the state of Oregon for over 20 years. Native Oregonian, currently reside in Bend, Oregon. The biggest challenge is this target market, and I've personally worked with many people, many businesses, and folks over the years with regard to retirement and retirement planning. And there's a significant lack of knowledge and education in this particular target market. Debt issues come into play, lower income scale. Many times they're just basically meeting needs. apathy, unfortunately, is also part of it. They just kind of don't care. They don't reach out. They don't take the time. The biggest obstacle for me as a financial advisor is modifying behavior and creating proper behavior. And oftentimes, savings isn't always a financial problem. Oftentimes, it may be more of a behavior problem. I think Senator Girard made reference to cashing out of an investment to pay credit card debt or pay off things. Certainly, there are reasons for people to do that. But certainly, part of my role as a financial advisor's education and trying to help modify the behaviors. Like I say, savings can be a habit. And I think as John mentioned, if we can create savers, those savers then can be opportunities for us and clients of ours in the future.
So I take it you're supportive of the bill?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Questions? Thank you. And did you want to speak? Yeah. You got it before. I got just a couple of minutes left.
I just got a quick question for you, maybe. Like, there's one who's in the House and one in the Senate. Are they exactly the same?
Are you from out of town too, sir? Yeah. Don't recognize you being around here all the time, so come on down.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, it's my pleasure to testify today in support of Senate Bill 615. My name is Georgia Hussey. I'm a certified financial planner in Portland. I've been in the industry for 5 years, and I've always focused on serving the underserved populations in our community. Currently, I focus on serving creative professionals and creative business owners in Portland. These clients are my focus because I'm only able to run a profitable planning practice if my clients can pay a flat fee of several thousand dollars or have assets of several hundred thousand dollars for me to manage for them. My peers and I have long struggled to find a way to help prepare our underserved working population for retirement. I've tried to engage with this group by chairing the Financial Planning Association of Oregon and Southwest Washington's pro bono committee, providing financial planning days through the city of Portland for several years, and we're just scratching the surface of the need. There's high costs providing service. Much of the working population is shut off from meaningful access to financial services, as you've just heard. And I think this is a great way to extend access to a far greater swath of Oregonians. Most clients come to me because they don't know where to start. And many people are under the impression that Social Security will support them in retirement. But having a defined contribution in place will provide an additional source of income for retirement, but also an understanding of one's own responsibility to provide for retirement, which is not clear to many people. Additionally, many people don't have access to retirement plans, and I also see that many employers who I help don't have the time or the skills or the knowledge to be able to implement plans in their own businesses. So this would be a great service to small business owners in Oregon. My hope is that if young people can start saving earlier, they will be able to someday work with somebody like me, and they won't have so large of a gap to bridge once they are able to really focus more of their intention around providing for retirement. So I just want to clarify that this plan would in no way compete for my business, with my business, and it would be a great complement to the financial industry. And thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My name is John, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Girard, and members of the committee. My name is John Calhoun. I'm a resident of Portland. I'm an entrepreneur, and last year our 7-year-old company finally created a 401k plan for employees. We had delayed setting it up because of the cost and complexity of a 401k. In addition to $1,100 setup fee, we pay $1,650 plus $40 per employee in annual fees. For a company with only a few employees, that is a high cost per employee. These costs do not go into the employee accounts, which is why we waited until our company was big enough to keep the cost down, and today we have 65 employees. To give you a sense of our employee population, our average hourly wage is about $18 per hour, and hourly employees make up 2/3 of our employees. Our typical employee is in their late 20s and early 30s. They were the ones who were requesting that we set this up. In spite of the fact that we do not provide any matching contribution, after only 1 year, we have about a 75% participation rate. This showed me both the need and the interest in a retirement plan. In addition to the fees we have to pay, I have a personal financial and legal exposure if the 401k is not properly administered. Finally, running a retirement plan is not how I want to spend my business time. That's why I find the proposal so
valuable. Under this program, we could have set this up for our employees at any time in our history with minimal effort and no administrative costs. The payroll deductions would be just more one more line item that we would, for our payroll service that we would deduct and pay out. Our early employees would now have a more substantial retirement fund based upon several years of savings. I'll leave it there.
Thank you.
My name is Richard Schwartz. I am here from Portland today, and I am here to urge the committee's support and recommendation for passage of Senate Bill 615. I submitted some written testimony, and I just will highlight a couple things to save time. But I served as vice chair of the Retirement Savings Task Force, and I support everything that you've heard about and from the task force representatives, the chair, Treasurer Wheeler, today, who put it in an awesome context for what we're facing and the need for this kind of program to take effect. I, in my work, I'm retired now, but in my work career, which spanned, I think, 8 jobs, if I remember them all, the first 4 had no retirement plan. One of them had, but only for employees, of which I was not eligible to participate. The others did, so today, even though I'm retired, I have to manage 4 different plans. This kind of plan that Senate Bill 615 talks about and proposes, it would be one that includes a major feature, which I would have appreciated, and that's portability, so that when you move from one employment setting to another, you can carry the plan with you and continue to make contributions. I would urge all of you, if you have not yet had an opportunity or have a staff person, read the full task force report and recommendations. This report covers most of the things that there have been questions about today and that continue to be questions as this moves forward. One example in the report takes what would have been the case if the 1997 proposal had gone through the legislature, and there's a chart included in the report that shows that somebody, if that had been in effect, and somebody in the Standard & Poor's annual averages increases had been invested in under from that time till today, somebody would have about $30,000, which is more than nothing, and they would not be in the circumstances they're in today without having retirement savings and be among those that are needing support today. So,
of course, if we put it in effect in 2007, it'd be a different picture.
Oh, that it covers that. Yeah. But also, just on the ERISA issue, briefly, at the time we had representatives of the Department of Labor on phone conference from Washington and locally from the Seattle office, and they were very, very clear. They would not answer and give specific advice on speculative questions. And everything at the time was speculative, and even some of the opposition today is speculating about what will be the case. It requires, before to put a specific plan in front of the Department of Labor for that kind of opinion to be rendered. And the bill itself, Senate Bill 615, says if it runs afoul of ERISA, I'm paraphrasing, that all bets are off. So I think the state is fully protected. There's mechanism for dealing with ERISA, and I don't think that the committee should be deterred in supporting Senate Bill 615 on that basis.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, I'm being kicked out of the room, so we're going to have to call it for today. We will schedule this again. This obviously is an important topic. Obviously, it's an important topic. We will schedule this again. This